Thanks for that, Brian Jennings at the news desk. And literally in a minute, I'll be talking to Sir John Major. But first, a recollection, as it were, from a clip, with a clip of Albert Reynolds speaking to me on the This Week programme at a time of great expectation, but turbulence as well in the peace process. It was December 1993.
I have no doubt that the document holds no real fears or genuine suspicions that we've been hearing from many unionist politicians and unionist leaders. I think that anybody who knows exactly where we're at would certainly admit that. And in all my contacts with various shades of unionist opinion, I'm finding that response, that it is fair and reasonable approach. And I think anything other than that, that's not fair and reasonable to both communities, not just to the unionists, but to the nationalist community as well. Because I think that there has to be a recognition by everybody that a system of government that does not command the support and allegiance of a very significant minority will hold no stability and no well-being for the future. That has been the case, and we want to start a new beginning that will provide a new framework for the relations between the two communities and indeed between the two parts of the island and between London and Dublin.
And that was Albert Reynolds speaking in December 1993. Sir John Major, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
And I think that was, Albert, previewing the declaration which was about to be issued by you and he and others at Downing Street. Now, it was something that was the fruits of a very tortuous process of negotiation, it's true to say.
Yes, it was very tortuous. I mean, the background is unrecorded because much of the background was a subject of private discussions between Albert and I. Albert was not only a very lovable man, but a very remarkable man. When we met for the first time with him as Taoiseach in Downing Street, after we had had the official meeting, we adjourned upstairs to the White Room and spoke privately, just the two of us. And we had a lengthy meeting then, and it was perfectly clear to both of us that it was necessary to strike out in a new direction, to seek a new approach to end the bloodshed in Northern Ireland and on the mainland. And it was clear to me that Albert was committed to that and was prepared to take risks for it. At that moment, he had a different end product in mind than I did, but we were both prepared to move in that direction. And Albert was a man prepared to take risks and prepared to do a deal in a good cause. And I thought that was very hopeful, and that was the beginning of what became known as the peace process.
How important was it that you had both, I think, worked together at European level, you as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he as Finance Minister here, how important was that engagement in building the trust that you've just been referring to?
I think it was helpful. I don't think it was crucial. Albert and I had got to know one another as Finance Ministers, and we'd shared many a joke together and the occasional drink together. But it was when he became Taoiseach that we actually focused on the problems of Northern Ireland and how to bring a rapprochement not just between North and South, but to improve the relations between East and West, between London and Dublin. Because until Albert became Prime Minister, shockingly really, there was no regular routine contact between the British Prime Minister and the Irish Taoiseach. And yet Ireland is Britain's nearest and closest neighbour. And that was absurd. And Albert was keen to put that right as well.
And what about particularly towards the end, it had been a dreadful few weeks prior to the Downing Street Declaration, most notably and notoriously the bomb, the Shank Hill road bomb, when I think about it, 12 people were killed. And then Mr. Adams had made that gesture of support to the bomber, Thomas Begley. That was something that really infuriated you when he carried his coffin. And you and Albert Reynolds, I think, had some very straight and stark words about that.
We did. We did, because we saw the problems becoming more and more entrenched. And I think Albert realized instinctively that if we did nothing and it became more entrenched, the hostility and the suspicions, and in some cases the hatreds, would become so intense, so entrenched, that they would be very difficult to reverse. And so what actually happened in those difficult few months, I think, steeled Albert towards making concessions, seeking a deal, demanding concessions from me, in the hope that we can actually move things onto a different plane. So the violence, from the point of view of those who were carrying out the violence, was counterproductive. It reinforced for us the need for a deal.
There was that summit as well at Dublin Castle prior to the Downing Street Declaration. I think that came in the week, literally in the week around about the 19th of December, leading up to Christmas. But there were some very tough exchanges. I think, were there accusations of bad faith? Because I think the British government had been revealed to be conducting negotiations through a back channel, or at least contact with the IRA, at a time when you had just said the very idea would have, I think, left your stomach churning.
Well, that's a little out of context, that point. You're certainly correct about the accusations of bad faith at Dublin Castle, and they came both ways. I had accusations of bad faith to make against Albert, and he had accusations of bad faith to make against me. And we repaired to a private room, and we had a pretty furious row. But the joy of the relationship with Albert from the start was that, in a fashion I can't quite explain, we were able to have the fiercest of rows without leaving scars and without leaving either of us less inclined to pursue the peace process than we were before. It was a clearing of the air. I think you have to realize in that process, Albert had to deal with some great difficulties on his side, not least, of course, with Sinn Féin and with the paramilitaries. And I had to deal on my side with some extremely hostile views among many members of Parliament, particularly in my own parties. So we both, in different ways, had difficult backbenchers that we had to keep in play, because too much hostility on either side might have wrecked the process. Now, I understood Albert's difficulties, and he understood mine. So when I accused him of bad faith, I knew why he'd done what he'd done. And when he accused me of bad faith, he understood why I had done what I had done. And that was what enabled us to have a row, sort it out, and return to the table and continue the negotiations. And it was a relationship unlike any other I had during my years in government.
What did he do that led you to make that accusation of bad faith?
Oh, it was a lot of backstage briefing. Albert, whom I love dearly, never passed a live microphone without a comment. And sometimes that caused me great difficulties at home. So that was what had happened on his side.
I'll ask his former spokesman, Sean Dignan, to come in on this after our conversation, Sir John. But coming forward to your, I think it might have been your most recent visit to Dublin on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of the Downing Street Declaration. You visited the Reynolds home and met with Albert. Can you tell us about that encounter?
Well, I've seen Albert a number of times and spoken to him more times since we left office. I think we can say without equivocation that during the Irish peace process, we became friends. I like Albert. I admire Albert. I enjoyed his company. And I enjoyed the company of Kathleen, his wife, and his family as well. So I have seen him in Dublin. When I saw him last time, he had his whole family came as well. And we had a pretty joyous couple of hours, actually. Albert wasn't well. His memory was beginning to go, and he wasn't at all well. That was very evident. But it was a delightful meeting, and one that I treasured then and treasure still.
So he is somebody clearly for whom you have great affection and also a very high regard as a fellow politician and peacemaker.
Well, I think he was more than a politician. People who took the risks that Albert took that could have caused him huge political difficulties and that he took for the greater good of ending bloodshed. I think that's not a politician. I think that's a statesman. And I think you can dignify Albert with that nomenclature. That's what he was. He knew what he was doing was very difficult, very politically difficult, and could have caused him huge problems. And he was undaunted by it because he believed that it needed to be done. And that I respect very much indeed.
Now, you referred to your own difficulties with some of the senior people on your backbenches, but other contributors earlier, Sir John Major, have referred to the fact that you were also numerically in the House of Commons. You didn't enjoy a huge majority as your successor, Tony Blair, did. You were actually dependent on the Ulster Unionists led by Sir James Molyneux at the time. That surely presented trouble as well.
Well, I think that argument has been grotesquely overdone. During the days that Jim Molyneux was there, he was unfailingly helpful. He had great difficulties with his own party, but he was very helpful. But the belief that I relied on the Ulster Unionists is actually absurd for a very practical reason. During the whole of the Irish peace process, I had a lot of support in the House of Commons from the Labour Party and from the Liberal Party. So my government may have been on the lip of a majority on many issues, but on many Irish issues, we had a lot of support, even though I didn't have a clear majority in my own party. So I think the belief that the Ulster Unionists materially impeded the peace process is a very good piece of news and very easy to write, and it was often written at the time, but it wasn't actually very accurate.
So John Major, former British Prime Minister and fellow peacemaker and friend of Albert Reynolds, thank you very much indeed for coming on the line there from London. Sean Dignan, I think I'll go to you first on this. That famous meeting, you write about it in your book, of course, but accusations of bad faith on both sides.
Yeah, well, John Major says we were briefing and they were briefing and there was bad faith. Now, with the greatest respect, let me say the British are no slouches at media manipulation. And we counter-briefed because we felt we had to. Just one example alone. At a vital moment before the Downing Street Declaration, it was revealed, it came out, that the British, who had been castigating us for this kind of making contacts with the IRA, had been talking to the IRA all along behind our backs. I remember Albert on the phone saying, "John, thanks very much. You're supposed to be my pal. You're having tea on the veranda with these guys and giving out to us." So, I would make no apologies for on Albert's behalf for how he dealt with the situation.
Funny thing on that one.
Noel Dempsey is with us now, yes.
Yeah, the funny thing about that one was I got a phone call before that meeting at Dublin Castle, sometime in the early hours of the morning, to be at Dublin Castle at around 6:30 or 7 o'clock, and that I was to go out and brief the media about this secret talks and so on. I use the phrase that Albert believes in, dealing off the top of the deck at the time. And for all that morning, I was out in front of the mics in Dublin Castle, given the reasons why we were, and Sean would have had a role in sending me out as well at the time, and the British were not at all happy with that. It's my recollection as well, Sean, that if this story hadn't come out, we could have been talking about a Dublin Castle declaration rather than a Downing Street declaration, that we were that close at that time. And because this story broke, it caused consternation on our side and not a little consternation on the other side.
I remember being in your office on a Saturday after European Summit, which again had happened literally within days of the Adams carrying Thomas Begley's coffin, and there had been some really robust exchanges en marge, as they used to say, about the European summits. And Albert explaining when he dropped in on the pair of us, as we maybe made some incursions onto a bottle of Blackbush or something like that, and he explained that, look, he had, you know, sort of said to Major in Brussels, he says, look, if Adams didn't carry that coffin, he could have been in the next one himself. That was the very straight kind of talking he did.
Well, yeah, and just to add to that, Albert's view. He said, look, John, I carry the coffin because Adams carries the coffin because otherwise he cannot deliver the IRA. Mm. You've got to understand that. That's what he has to do. There's no way, if he doesn't carry the coffin, he won't be able to deliver the provisional IRA. And that was a fact. Mm.
Pat Farrell is also here, former General Secretary of Fianna Fáil, and also Sam Smith. Sam, maybe we'll just wind back the years a bit and talk not so much about politics. And I know you're very familiar with the politics and you have written very acutely about it as well. But you probably came across Albert Reynolds in your early journalistic days, maybe more in the, shall we say, the business and also showbiz sphere.
Oh, yes. I knew him before I was in journalism. I had met him, didn't know him very well, but he was a very successful promoter of bands around the country and became very wealthy. And one of the things, same man doing deals then, as did the political deals later, very straight up and down. One thing, for instance, he would have been famous for, and that is there were other promoters at the time And bands would drive for 7 hours, sometimes 8 hours, going to a gig somewhere. And when they arrived there, they'd get a slice of cold ham, a leaf of lettuce and a tomato, tea, bread and butter, with hardly sustenance now after a drive like that. But at every Reynolds gig, you went to the local hotel and you got steak and chips and a proper dinner. And he had a reputation. He always paid on the night. If two people turned up, you got paid your full fee. And I knew him through that and always liked him. He was very funny. Now, he didn't drink in those days, which also made him interesting, but he would sit and drink cups of tea until 4 or 5 in the morning. You know, that's the...
Yeah, I think actually we can, just on that topic, Sam, we have a clip of Albert talking about his foray, or forays rather, maybe, into the music business.
I was the only member of the family to go on to secondary school. I got a scholarship in those days at Summerhill College in Sligo. It got you used to getting away from home, made you very independent. You had to make do with what you had. You had to sort of manage your resources, whatever, however limited they were, or try to improvise, which indeed I remember I got involved in and others got involved in it. We used to jump over the wall and go down the town in Sligo and bring up bars of chocolate or sweets and sell them at a profit. I was working with CIE at the time, and I was secretary to a local carnival committee for raising money for church renovation funds for about 3 years, booking the marquee, booking the bands. At the end of 3 years, when the local priest had enough money he got for the church, having made all the arrangements for the following year, for example, he just said, no, that's enough, I have enough, you do what you wish at this stage. So I went ahead subsequently it was successful, and the following year, my brother came home, Jim came home from Australia, and we decided this was a business maybe worth trying, so we bought a site for a ballroom beside the house where we were living and built our first ballroom there at Cloudland in Rooski. He built them himself, but I wasn't then in that end of the business. I was more the administration and booking the bands, looking after the money, paying the guys. Kenny Ball, Midnight in Moscow. It's a traditional jazz band. I brought them to Ireland first on the first tour in 1961. And on the night that I had them in the Ulster Hall in Belfast, I took the hall for the night, promoted the dance. They went number one in the Luxembourg hit parade, which was the big one at the time. And the Midnight in Moscow went number one then. I remember I bought the house that I'm presently living in Longford for the proceeds of the trip. And to that it has great affection for me.
Night in Moscow, the making of a multi-million career for Albert Reynolds, Sam, but he built up an absolute string of ballrooms he was talking about there.
Around, and they're all called Land, Cloudland, Dreamland. They all, and now they were stark enough buildings too. They were big,
even starker now, those that are still standing.
Breeze block sort of things. There was no drinks in. They sold bottles of orange. But John, just something there, when he was talking there about growing up, when you look at politics here, there are conventions, there is an orthodoxy about how it's done. And if you look at, a lot of what has been done recently is done by people who went to Clongowes and Gonzaga and on the UCD. I suppose they'd almost be the equivalent of our Eton and Oxbridge sort of thing. Albert didn't. Albert was a CIE clerk. He looked at things from quite a new and unique perspective, which was very perplexing for some of the people around them, but it did get things done at times. But sadly, at the end, not having that history and so on perhaps helped in his undoing.
Really? What was missing then?
Well, he broke the rules, and you don't ever get anywhere unless you break the rules. That is how things get done. That's how he delivered the peace process. He broke the rules so differently from everybody else. But when you look, he got into rows with Desi O'Malley that he probably shouldn't have. There was an easy way to step around that, and various rows that he did. Now, Pat might have another view on that, but that's the man.
Pat Farrell, former General Secretary of Fianna Fáil.
I wouldn't disagree with Sam's assessment, but I have to say that Albert was Albert, and I don't think he could unmake him. And I think what he was in terms of his ability to seize an opportunity, his absolute resilience in terms of going after what he saw as something that was worth pursuing, was the essence of him. And 9 times out of 10, it worked. And on a couple of occasions, he didn't pull back when maybe he might have. and the rest is history. But I have to say, when you look at the risks he took for peace, the risks he took in a whole lot of other areas in terms of taking on the modernisation of the telecom sector and all the other areas, most politicians are very risk averse. They shrink from it and they think about the optics of it and then haven't analysed it to death. They possibly find themselves in inaction. Albert was the absolutely unconventional politician. He saw the opportunity. In fact, his phrase that he uttered on so many occasions, opportunity comes to pass, but not to pause. And by God, did he seize the opportunities. And we're all the better for it.
I think that Albert saw politics as a means to an end. Most politicians see politics as an end in itself. And I think Sam's point is just spot on there in relation to it. He was a man in a hurry. He had a clear vision of what he wanted. I mean, we're all talking about the peace process and we talk about other things that Albert did. But Albert's main thing was to bring us economic prosperity to the country. And one of the big blocks to that at the time was the peace, or the troubles in Northern Ireland. And that was one thing that he had to do earlier on when he was in communications. The big block was, and totally antiquated telecommunication system and so on. So Albert had a vision.
Now, he may also have inherited a plan. He might have been fortunate in his timing there. Now, he ran very well with it in the modernisation of the communications thing. It didn't actually begin with him. People like maybe the late Pádraig Faulkner would have pointed out.
You could say the same about the peace process and so on. But he was a man that when he got the opportunity, didn't do all of the cross T's and dot I's and everything. He just went for it and did it.
Can I situate him for you in the peace process in a situation? And I think...
And it was interesting, by the way, that conference, our concert was in the King's Hall in Belfast, I think, or the Ulster Hall, I'm not sure which. Ulster Hall, when Kenny and that's the kind of experience on the ground in Northern Ireland that stood to him. Sorry,
there's a particular episode in the peace process, and it didn't get chronicled until quite recently, but I think it has been in a fashion. And it was around the time that the Army Council of the IRA, I think, were destined to meet to decide whether they were going to put in place the ceasefire or not. And I think there were votes in North America to be had, to be lost or to be won. And I think the common consent at the time was that unless one of the old warriors of Army Council, also known as Joe Cahill, could be dispatched to the States to swing the vote, it would probably fall. And Albert, there was a little problem, very big problem actually, which was that Joe Cahill was persona non grata. He couldn't get a visa. When the State Department excludes you from the States, only the President can reverse it. And Albert, I remember going into his office the next morning where he had a day's beard on him because he literally through the night had personally chased Bill Clinton across the United States and eventually gotten him to make the call to the State Department, get the visa. Cahill flew, the vote took place, and the peace process happened.
Yeah, that's very important.
And I mean, that was critical intervention by Albert.
It almost didn't happen, that last minute hitch. You see, we've thought that because Gerry Adams, Albert had got Gerry Adams a visa a couple of months earlier. So we figured, what's the problem with Joe Cahill? It was pointed out by Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States. Huge difference. Adams had a very small criminal record. The other man was a convicted murderer. He was actually, Joe Cahill was actually condemned to death. He was reprieved. So that they pointed out, the US authorities, that it would be a major precedent. If Cahill was allowed in. So as Pat says, he spent all night, first of all, to Nancy Soderbergh, who was a top aide to Clinton. He got so tired that she kept saying, look, Cahill is a different thing. He said, Nancy, damn it, I never said we were dealing with saints. And eventually he got through to Clinton. He gave Clinton a personal assurance that there would be a permanent ceasefire if Cahill could just get in. Cahill had to talk to the IRA supporters in the United States to tell them what was happening. Eventually the word came through. The president had decided to give Cahill a visa. And that was it. It was over then.
Another very important strand. And also, I want to talk now shortly about the famous heave, or maybe kind of a rolling heave against Charles Haughey. And Tom Savage will be joining us on the line. But let's just recall And there were, I suppose, more. There was more than one row. There was one of them, I think, I won't say you were part of it, Sean, but you maybe facilitated Jerry Collins' famous appearance. You were on the 6-1 at the time when he made that appeal to Albert. But I think we have a clip now of Albert Reynolds in a robust discussion with Jerry Collins. This after Sean Pearn, I think Noel Dempsey, you might have been part of this as well, put down a motion of no confidence in Charles Haughey in 1991.
There comes a time when you have to say enough is enough and call a halt. Otherwise, I should go out of politics, forget about it. Sorry, I don't see a reason why I should resign. Every Fianna Fáil deputy has a democratic right to express his or her opinion on a motion that's before the party on Saturday. I'm exercising that right.
I genuinely feel that the declaration this evening by Albert Reynolds that he's to try and vote Charlie Haughey out of office and take it on for himself, I think this is going to wreck our party right down the centre and is going to burst up government, and is certainly not going to serve the best interests of the people. I believe that what Albert is doing now is so wrong that he should even at this late stage pull back from wrecking the government and throwing the country into a state of panic and chaos. And I, for my part, I'm supporting my Taoiseach. I trust him. I respect his authority, his office and the dignity of that office.
And that's just an extract. Sorry, we did have it. It was that exchange on the 6-1. I don't know what you said to him that set him off, Sean Dyke.
Well, I actually, do you know what? People said to me that was a great interview. I said nothing. I was about to open my mouth and Jerry took off. And there was no holding him. And, you know, the only thing I did was I gave the signal. The only contribution I made was the signal to keep it going. Let him off. Let him off. And he certainly took off.
Our late lamented friend, Gerald Barry, often said the most important thing for an interviewer at times to do is keep his or her mouth shut. And that was one of those occasions. As I say, we'll be talking to Tom presently. But Noel Dempsey, you were at the heart of that row. It was, again, you, like others, were fairly young at the time. And you decided to get stuck in.
Yeah, it was. We were after having. Well, there were several incidents that had happened, and there was a lot of controversy in the party at the time. And four of us decided at one stage that we were. We became known as the Gang of Four, that we would issue a statement saying that we didn't like the way Charlie Haughey was handling things. And that caused a huge furore in the party. There was a meeting about it. No action was taken one way or the other. And. Then some further incidents. They're probably too numerous to mention, and we won't go into it.
There was an interview, I think, that Charlie Haughey might have had a hand in it myself, yes, where he talked about these Chinese leaders.
That was the Gang of Four issued their statement as a result
they
of that.
They go until they're 80 or 90.
Yeah, that frightened the living daylights out of everybody at that stage. But then a few weeks after that, because of a continuation of one of the rows, Sean Power put the motion of no confidence down. The first time Sean would have put it down the time we issued the statement, but we persuaded him otherwise. MJ Nolan, Sean Power, myself and Liam Fitzgerald were the four that were involved in that. But the motion went down, and that first clip that we heard was Albert's response. He eventually came out. There was a sense of frustration in the party at that time, Sean, because the younger TDs, and I was only in there from 87, Sean Power from 89, the other two lads were there from earlier on, that nobody at a senior level was doing anything, or curbing Charlie Haughey, as we saw it at that time. And at the end of it all, we sat down and we just said, if they're not going to do it, we'll do it.
Did you try to get Albert to front up on this,
no,
or did you? Were you in cahoots with him?
No. That I can genuinely say that at no stage did we talk to Albert about it or anything else. There may have been other things going on that we weren't aware of, because we would have been very junior backbenchers. When Sean put down the notice of motion, I think that probably Albert and some of the rest decided that it was time to stand up.
Right, here's another clip of Albert Reynolds explaining his decision to challenge Charlie Haughey. Now, this may have come later.
I have no doubt from what I've heard before and from then either, but or indeed subsequently, that there was a very large volume of support for me, indeed, that was unsolicited, and indeed that I hadn't asked for, and I was very, very satisfied and very flattered by it. And I was told quite clearly by the middle ground of the party that it would be there for me at any given stage in the future, but that their views was that a bruising, bitter, divisive campaign would not be in the best interest of the party, and I put the best interest of the party before what my own personal ambitions might be. And I believe that in the end of the day, that is the wise decision, and everybody sees that at this stage. There are some who don't. There are some, indeed, at the extreme ends of who would say, look, you should have gone ahead, you should have done this, and you should have done that. But I think a wiser and better balanced decision was arrived at. I recommended that to my supporters, and they accepted it.
That's Albert Reynolds speaking, I think, around the time of the October heave. Now, Tom Savage is on the line. Tom, you, I think it's true to say, were maybe part of the Albert kitchen cabinet around those years.
That's true, along with Bart and Diggy, although I don't know if Diggy would want to be described as being part of the kitchen cabinet. He was in a very official position, but also good to know that Pat and Noel and Sam are there. But yes, first of all, can I say, and I don't mean this just to be a mealy-mouthed thing, that I couldn't start without extending the very deepest personal sympathies to Albert's wife, Kathleen, and his family. Now, that's not said in a perfunctory way, because anyone who knew Albert Reynolds would know that his family was always his first love and his greatest preoccupation. And in fact, more often than not, kitchen cabinet is the right way to describe, because I had more meetings with him in his kitchen with tea being served to both of us by Kathleen. And that's where a lot of the discussions actually took place. But just to come down, I think that Albert Reynolds, wherever he is, and I've no doubt if there's a heaven he's in it, will be absolutely thrilled today to see that history is beginning to be very, very generous in the appreciation of what he has contributed to Ireland and to Irish society. And to hear John Major describe him as a statesman I think he would rate that as one of the top tributes that has been paid to him. But let me pick up on one thing from the kitchen cabinet, and that was his willingness to take risks, which he did for peace, but he also did it in other ways as well. Because in the peace thing, he was never shackled into rigidity by political ideology. And as a result, he learned, therefore, to create the trust with others, particularly with the paramilitaries in the north, even though sometimes that wasn't accepted or welcomed totally by the classical politicians. But coming to risks on the home front, the night before the heave in November 91, Noel may not remember it all, even if he was junior, but he'll remember many of the elements. But on the night before, I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting in the kitchen with Albert, and he said, come on now, he said, earn your money. What do you think I should do? Should I support Sean Power's vote of no confidence, or should I not? And I said to him, and this will show you about being a risk taker, I said, well, Albert, if you don't oppose Haughey, there is no possibility you will ever lead Fianna Fáil. But if you do oppose Haughey, there's every possibility you'll never lead Fianna Fáil. And I said, there you are. And he said, right. And he decided he would actually walk in and vote against Haughey. But he also showed his tactical nous at the same time, because he sent an instruction out to those of his closest supporters that they were not to support the vote of no confidence. They were to go into the lobby or the count supporting Haughey, so that Haughey would never know what was the extent of the forces that were actually potentially that could be marshalled against him.
I think that was an open roll call vote. I think we got the numbers, or sorry, the names, we read them out on the This Week programme the following day, and this was the meeting, there was talk of white vans and all the rest of it. But then moving on a few months, Tom, Sean Doherty emerged down the road from us here in the Montrose Hotel, then a hotel, and he spilled the beans on the use of the tape recordings and whatever. You were in the background to that as well, in Doherty's kitchen at the time.
Well, I suppose that's true, but probably in our own kitchen where our office was, because this was after Nighthawks. And suddenly, and I have to say, inspired by his wife, marvellous woman with great political nous as well, Sean Doherty decided that he was going to front up and say what was the real situation about the tapes. Now, I decided I'm keeping strum about this. I'm not going to say anything. But RTE, famously, Sean, I don't know if you remember it, were on strike at the
with great
time.
Regret. Sorry, yeah. we were on strike at the time, weren't we?
Oh, you were. And you see, that was part of our, if you like to call it, nefarious planning, that if Sean Doherty was to give a speech at 8 o'clock in the evening, there'd be no option for RTE but to cover it live because there'd be no facilities. I say this now as chairman of RTE, striking my breast, but there'd be no facilities for editing, and therefore whatever he needed to say would go unedited and unchanged. And then his instructions were to make himself scarce. And he did. He disappeared, I think, for almost a week. But on that occasion, I picked up the phone. He was to go start his press conference at 8 o'clock. And at about 2 minutes to 8, I rang Albert. And I told him what I thought would be the height of good news for him. And he went absolutely apoplectic. I mean, he swore down the phone, cursing Doherty. And I was taken aback, thinking, why is he not glad of this opportunity to topple the man that he had been trying from November in speeches and other to set himself up as an alternative choice?
Yeah, he'd left the cabinet
but
at that
really
stage.
He really was apoplectic, and he slammed down the phone. And that was it. But he at least knew that something was going to happen. Now, it took me months to discover why he did that. And to round out the story, in fact, what happened was Albert, as well as being very open, was also very cellular in that he often didn't tell certain people what was happening in other areas. And as a result, I realized a few months later that he had a quite separate arrangement with another man, whom I'll name in a moment, to actually get a commitment, and had got a commitment from Charles Haughey that he would actually resign within a couple of months. And he was very much afraid that what Doherty was doing would make the backbenchers and others in Fianna Fáil believe that he, Albert, was responsible and that it would spoil what would other have been a bloodless coup. And the man that was doing the deal was Dr. John O'Connell, who had some particular reason or pressure on Haughey as a result of issues with Arab potentates, that Haughey agreed that he would go quietly. And that's what annoyed Albert, but he never told the rest of us that.
And did John O'Connell have something in writing about that?
He didn't have something in writing, but it cropped up in another way. When eventually the team that were working with on behalf of Albert for the coming leader of Fianna Fáil were Michael Smith, Charlie McCreevy and myself. And when we were well through that campaign, and when, Albert more or less had the feel to himself that Bertie Ahern had withdrawn, we were having a discussion, and I think it was Michael Smith said, I see that the boss has said in public that he has given a commitment to no one about who will be in his cabinet. And I smiled, as did our friend, who did I say the third was?
Charlie McCreevy.
I smiled, as did Charlie. And I said, I believe he's given a commitment to one person. And McCreevy said, so do I. And Michael Smith was very baffled and said, what do you guys know that I don't know? And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll write down the person I think he's given a commitment to. And similarly, my opposite number wrote down whom he thought he had given a commitment to, and we passed the papers to each other. And they both had the same name on it, and the name on it was John, the Minister for Health, who became Minister for Health in the government.
John O'Connell.
John O'Connell. And in fact, we both knew that he had given a commitment because it was John that had got the arrangement for what would happen with Haughey in the long run.
Tom, thank you very much indeed for that recollection of very interesting and intriguing times. And we'll be talking about that with our studio panel and others after this short break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.
Lots of texts, one of them saying it's an irony of timing that the Roseland Ballroom in Moat should be demolished just 5 weeks ago. My friend, the late Colin Murray, had some great stories about that and the building of it. And I think he, in the family shop, had sold various bits of sweets and ice cream and all the rest of it to Albert and his people at the time. May they both rest in peace. Another text saying, Reynolds' stubbornness wasn't a weakness, but the very reason for his success. He was genuinely appalled by the deaths we could do with someone to believe in talks in Ukraine and the other trouble spots of our world in the same fashion. And Dennis John in Mayo says, Albert didn't run away from a challenge. He set standards in decency and honesty which should be copied by the body politic. Pat Farrell, former General Secretary of Fianna Fáil, I know you were under some time pressure, so I just want to ask you about one thing. We talked earlier to Mary McAleese, and it was her day that was Albert acknowledged when she, not he, was chosen as the Fianna Fáil candidate in 1997 for the presidency. You set that up, didn't you?
I did not. I think you had some fair bit of discussion about it earlier on, in fact. And as I recall it in the day, I mean, Albert, obviously, all I would say about it is I think Albert would have made an excellent president. But the party chose on the day, Mary McAleese was selected as the candidate, and she went on to serve two terms, and she did an excellent job.
Was it not you and Bertie Hearn's basically made sure the votes went the right way for her? Well, you were General Secretary.
I've seen some chronicling of it, and I haven't seen that, but all I know
have I grossly misinterpreted and misrepresented the truth?
I think you have, because I think at the end of the day, it was the parliamentary party actually that made the decision. And the last time I checked, I didn't run that particular organisation.
No, which might have been helpful in making known the views of the party leader as to what the best way forward was.
No, I can genuinely tell you that was not the case. But I do know that I met Albert, obviously, many times after that. And I know that at any time I met him, that never arose or never was discussed. And I think that on the day that's in it, the focus rightly is on his huge achievements as Taoiseach. And again, because I didn't get the chance to say it earlier on, I would like to extend, again, my deepest sympathies to Kathleen and the family. I think it's very right that there should have been so much focus on the personal man, because inevitably on these occasions is the public figure. But he had an extraordinary bond with his family, and Kathleen and the kids were his, I think, his best and most consistent advisors.
It was an extraordinary experience to go into that family home. They got on so well, and they all were so affectionate towards one another, and they clearly worshipped him, and they were so well-reared and so well-behaved. I remember meeting them. They were all, I think, teenagers at the time, in the late 70s, early 80s, around Ardesh time. It would be kind of open house in the apartment over the road there in Ballsbridge. I'm sure you would have had that same experience as well, Noel Dempsey.
Absolutely. Coming from a large family myself, it was very noticeable, and it didn't matter what age the kids were. If they had a view, they expressed it, and Albert listened to it. You know, it was a really remarkable experience.
Now, I know you don't want to say anything unseemly on the day, but can you shed any light on the machinations that led to Mary McAleese rather than Albert Reynolds emerging as the candidate?
Ken, I might ask Pat, I think. I was asked at the time, on the run-up to that parliamentary party meeting, to go to Canada, I think it was. I was sent off. The Taoiseach was supposed to go, and I was sent off to. So I wasn't actually there for the parliamentary party meeting. I would have supported Albert. I've said that to Mary McAleese at the time and everything else. The one mystery that I've had, I don't know whether Pat can shed any light on this or not. Other people who were away were told that they actually had a vote. They could vote by proxy.
But there were sealed envelopes.
Sealed envelopes. Nobody ever told me that. And I didn't get to cast my vote in the parliamentary party. So Albert would have had one more.
I think the person who chaired the meeting was, I think, Rory O'Hanlon. And he set the ground rules. And he did decide at the outset that, in fact, people in absentia could cast a vote, which was unusual, I have to say. And at a point in time, Fianna Fáil, by the way, is a great party for making it up as they go along in terms of rules. And on that occasion, given that the vote was a shock, I think, to be quite frank, on the first round, genuinely so, the question was immediately put from the floor by people who would be supporters, I'd say, of Albert's, as to what happened in the subsequent rounds as regards these votes. And I think Rory Hanlon turned to me for an adjudication of the matter, which was the first time as a general secretary I've ever been at a parliamentary party, never mind being called to adjudicate on the rules of the party. And I decided, which I thought was the most practical, logical thing at the time, is that it was a new ball game and that there should be no more votes, because you couldn't divine what people's further intentions were. But that just shows actually how...
Yeah, David Andrews, I think, was he a would-be candidate at the time as well? Or
no, Michael O'Kennedy.
It was Michael O'Kennedy, sorry. Yeah.
But that just shows actually how what a shock, literally, the first round vote was on the occasion.
Right, Pat, I know you want to go on. Thank you very much indeed for coming to studio on this sad day, I think, for people who would have admired and liked and worked with Albert Reynolds. He died this morning, I think, after a very long illness. He suffered from Alzheimer's. Sam Smith, you, I think, could identify with a lot of what what Tom Savage was saying to us earlier on the phone about the and the time that Albert became party leader and stuff that was going on in the background that very few people knew about.
Story, and it didn't get the purchase, probably. I would have expected to get more parts, but basically the story was that Hockey was digging in, didn't want to go. Albert was working in the background. Now, most people thought that, you know, Albert had put Sean Doherty up to going on Nighthawks and causing the big row about the things. But actually, in the background, there's a man called Dermot O'Leary, who was a Fianna Fáil activist in Dublin, Dr. John O'Connell. There's Dublin South Central, I think they were involved in. And they had a meeting with Charlie Hockey in Mr. O'Leary's house in Sutton. And they put it to him, basically, that Dr. John O'Connell had been the conduit for some money from Saudi Arabian people to Mr. Hockey, and Dr. John O'Connell had written a cheque to Hockey, so therefore he had all the records of it, and they more or less put it to Hockey that he would have to resign, or they said give a time, and I was told at the time by people who were there that yes, it did happen. Now, one of the big surprises...
And when was that meeting, and how much time then was Charlie Hockey given?
In January 1992, I think Hockey resigned January, February 1992.
More or less simultaneous or contemporaneously with the Doherty move.
Yeah, I thought at that time it was belt and braces, you know, that there was one going one way and another. Now, I actually believe that to be true, and... Hockey did step down. And Dr. John O'Connell, you must remember, was appointed Minister for Health, and that came out of the blue for everybody.
A very interesting recall there, Sam. Of course, Albert Reynolds was elected as a TD in 1977 for the old Longford West Meath constituency, but he was fundamentally, I think, a Longford man. And Valerie Cox has been on the streets of Longford this morning speaking to local people about Albert Reynolds.
Albert Reynolds was actually... like Joe Dolan with the song, he was a good man in his own peculiar way. He did a lot for the people in Northern Ireland. And any one life saved in Northern Ireland is a life saved. That meant a lot. To be fair to the man, he did good work. He behaved very well to become a Taoiseach from being an ordinary working man. Normally, people that hold down them positions are barristers, teachers, solicitors, those type of people. He took up something that Gary Fitzgerald had started, that never got any recognition for it. He took up that, but to be fair to him, he did good work there. He set the foundation stones.
And do you think he's got the recognition for what he did?
I don't think he got enough. That's my honest opinion. He was politically naive when he was dealing with Dick Spring. That was one of his mistakes.
The best man ever seen working in my life. He was absolutely brilliant. No matter what you wanted, he was there to do it for you. That's really all I can say about him.
And he provided a lot of jobs around here.
Oh, he did, yeah. Several jobs. It's not like it was now. It is now. It was absolutely brilliant, you know, with him around, you know. He was class.
I thought the world of him. Now, and that's to be quite honest. He's a great man.
Did you know him in his show business days?
No, I didn't actually. I've been in the halls when they used to do the...
You danced there?
Yeah. I was young then. That's a few years ago now, for old Albert. I didn't realise I heard it this morning.
What was he like?
He was a people's Taoiseach.
He'll be remembered.
He will be remembered, certainly will.
A very good businessman. He took chances. He had full confidence in himself. He was a very good worker. I think he's a pioneer. He wasn't a pioneer, but he never drank any cups of tea. He got the social welfare pact. That's very important.
I thought he was the most wonderful man ever that Longford ever got as a Taoiseach, and we're very sad that he didn't get longer as a Taoiseach. But I think we're heartbroken in the town today, and he was in a business partnership with my father. Jimmy Malloy, he was part of the Longford News and the Dancing Gazette. It went out to all the pop stars and that. It was the paper of the time, and they were very great pals. And it's a little bit personal today. And to him, or to Kathleen and his family, I wish to extend our deepest sympathy to them.
And those were the views gathered on the streets of Longford this morning by Valerie Cox. Still in studio with me, Sam Smith, Sean Dignan, and former minister and friend of Albert Reynolds, Noel Dempsey. Sam, I think you come from a strongly Protestant background in Belfast. Albert Reynolds was a staunch practicing Catholic, but you had to educate him a bit on in matters to do with religion on the Catholic variety.
And it's been on reeling in the years. Very briefly, it was 1981. The Aer Lingus jet had been hijacked by an Australian former monk, and nobody knew what he wanted. I met Albert at the airport, and he says, "What does this fellow want?" I says, "I believe he wants to know the third secret of Fatima." And he says, "What's that?" I says, "It's a secret, Albert. That's why it is there." And he says, "Oh, so then we didn't know that some people from ITV had a mic on us at the time." And later, Albert was asked about the third secret of Fatima. He says, "It's a religious thing."
Sean Dignan, we constantly through the programme this morning over the last 2 hours or so, people have talked about taking risks, the risk taker. There was one final risk that he took.
See, always there's, you go one risk too many. It was the appointment of Harry Whelan as President of the High Court, despite Labour ministers warning that they wouldn't come into Cabinet if Albert did it. And he said to me, "You know, I don't know whether they'll come in or not, but I'm going to go ahead with the appointment with or without them." And I was, of course, appalled. First of all, that Labour would make this threat. Secondly, that Albert was going to call their bluff, as he saw it, and betting everything he had, including his job on it. In the event, it proved one risk too many for Albert, and it cost him his job.
And you quote Maura Geoghegan Quinn, I think, up in the Oris that day, saying, "In a fear stage whisper, I'm saying this to your face, Harry Whelan. When I'm out in the snow on the election trail in Galway and people on the doorsteps ask me, what about Harry Whelan, I'm going to reply..."
Now, the word I used was "to hell with Harry Whelan," but Maura Geoghegan Quinn, I was being too nice. Jerry Barry warned me, say what she said, but I was too nice. Maura herself said afterwards, "I didn't say to hell with Harry, I used another word."
Okay, in the vernacular. Noel Dempsey, again, you want to recall a conversation you had, I think, in the early stages of the peace process.
In the early stages of the peace process, one night after Dáil business on a Wednesday night, Albert would very often invite me up for a he'd have a cup of tea and we'd chat about what was going on. But he introduced this concept to me on one of these occasions about deleting Articles 2 and 3 from the Constitution. And I says, "Albert, what are you talking about? You're mad. You can't do that." He said, "I know, we'll be balancing it off now with the Government of Ireland Act 1921 and we'll be getting something in return for that." And I says, it's a huge risk. I said, you're going to have a job getting the party to come with you. And he just said, "If I save one life during my political career, that's enough."
We'll just have one parting few words or a clip from Albert Reynolds, his final speech from the Dáil, but we'll have to have it just after this short break.
Tweet at TodaySOR.
Our opening words on today's billboard were "Death of a Statesman." 2 hours later, to borrow a phrase from Albert Reynolds, I think we can say we're vindicated. We've had 2 hours of tributes and recollection to the man who died this morning. Again, our sympathies to his family. By the way, Tom Savage has confirmed that John O'Connell did have a signed letter from Haughey committing himself to go. Today's programme was produced by Sean O'Gorman. Kieran Dunn was on sound research by Jonathan Doyle, and broadcast assistant was Maeve Mooney. We'll be hearing shortly from Ronan Collins, but let's have a listen now to a few words, a brief extract from Albert Reynolds' resignation speech in the Dáil in 1994.
"I wish to announce to the Dáil that I intend, following this statement, to go to Áras an Uachtaráin to tender my resignation as Taoiseach and that of my ministers to the President. I will not be seeking a dissolution of the Dáil. And lastly, I can call you I want to take the opportunity of thanking Kathleen, my children, and my grandchildren for the great support that they gave me in carrying the heavy burdens of office these days. I thank them indeed for their commitment and for staying the course with me. And I look forward, as they do, and there was a very happy family there this morning, to say farewell. Thank you.
Tweet at Today SOR.